And if you go back in time, really to the beginning of the United States, we've had 9 of these major panics. And there've been, I don't know, like probably a dozen minor ones. So if really they're pretty common things, but when you're in the midst of one, I think it's easy to lose that context. Think like, oh my God, like the world is over. Like banks are going to go, you know, out of business. But really it's a pretty regular thing in the financial system.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. All eyes around the world are currently on the banking system and the shockwaves rippling through it. How bad is the risk of further contagion? And what's likely to happen next? And how are the bankers themselves looking at the situation? How worried are they? To find out, we're fortunate to talk with banking analyst John Maxfield today. He spent the past several decades covering the banking system and the players in it. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here, Adam.
Well, John, I'm very excited for this discussion. This is the first time you and I are meeting face-to-face. You are a referral from Edwin Dorsey from the Bear Cave, who gave a phenomenal interview on this channel. Great young talent. Really appreciate him connecting us, and the connection could not be more timely with everything that's going on in the world with the banking system. So lots of questions here for you, but let me just start with a high-level one. It's kind of a variant of the one I like to ask everybody who comes on this channel. What's your current assessment of the banking system?
Well, you know, my current assessment is probably similar to everybody else's, although maybe with a little bit more historical context. So we're in the midst of maybe kind of on the kind of moving towards the end of kind of a classic bank panic. And in a bank panic, what happens is there's concern that depositors will lose their money. And when that happens, there are runs on the banks that they think that that's going to happen at. So we saw that with Silicon Valley Bank. We saw it with Silvergate. It wasn't a run, but there was kind of a similar situation where it voluntarily shut down. First Republic, we've seen it with them. So we're seeing a lot of these banks losing a lot of deposits. And if you go back in time, really to the beginning of the United States, we've had 9 of these major panics. And there've been, I don't know, like probably a dozen minor ones. So if really they're pretty common things, but when you're in the midst of one, I think it's easy to lose that context. Think like, oh my God, like the world is over. Like banks are going to go, you know, out of business. But really it's a pretty regular thing in the financial system.
Okay. So regular thing in the financial system. Banks go out of business all the time. And this was sort of one of the things that was being discussed 2 weekends ago. I had Joseph Wang here on the channel. He goes by Fed Guy. He used to work as a Fed trader, so he really sort of understands how the plumbing of the banking system works. And he was saying, yeah, hey, look, you know, Silicon Valley Bank isn't a systemically important bank, certainly not the way like a Lehman was. And we have a process for dealing with banks that get overextended and fail. And that's what was happening the weekend he and I were talking, where the FDIC had come in on Friday and was, you know, basically getting the bank ready to reopen the next week. Yes, we do have this process now. Silicon Valley Bank wasn't, it was shown some what's the right way to say it, maybe largesse by the government, because they did have some fears that, yes, while it's not a systemically important bank, there is enough fear going on right now that, you know, people may rush out to their other regional banks and start withdrawing money and take what would otherwise be a well-managed, well-run bank and put that in jeopardy, sort of an unnecessary bank run to that standpoint. So, you know, we're not just letting the system run, you know, itself autonomously here. There is some intervention that's still going on here. And I want to go through, you know, sort of what the government has done to date and get your sense as to whether that was the right thing to do, whether there was maybe something else we could be doing. And obviously, this isn't a U.S. story at all at this point in time. And headlines have been very focused on what's been going on with Credit Suisse, which is a very systemically important bank. And I'm curious to see if you think that the steps that have been taken there are right and sufficient, or if you're more concerned about contagion from that.
Let me give you one other context that I think you'll find interesting and kind of sure. Like context for like thinking about this stuff.
Sure.
The thing about banking is that, so in any other industry, what is the primary you face these constraints, right? And the primary constraint you face in virtually any other industry is scarcity. Scarcity of supply, scarcity of demand, scarcity of real estate, scarcity of employees, scarcity of everything, right? Banking, it's the exact opposite. The primary constraint you face in banking is abundance. It's abundance. Managing when there's too much of something, okay? That's why these liquidity surges start these new cycles, okay? And so you think like, okay, well, what does that mean? What does that like mean like in terms of like running a business? Like, and this is what it means. If you're running a regular business, it's like you're on the planet Earth and you're facing gravity and you're trying to jump up and all the effort is trying to get off the ground, right? That's all the effort. Banking, it's literally like you're on the moon. All the effort is just to stay down on the ground. Don't grow too fast. Don't grow too fast. Don't grow too fast. Everybody else is trying to grow. You're trying to throttle your growth. So it's like they face the exact opposite constraints of a typical business. And so like why have 18,000 banks failed since the Civil War? This is why, because humans are not designed to deal with abundance. And there just are not very many good bankers in this country. I mean, I could literally list out probably a dozen bankers that are any good in this country. And there's 4,700 banks, and I know a lot of them, you know what I mean? And that's why, because we're just not designed to do that. It takes like a Warren Buffett type mentality to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. And of course, you know, you give somebody more money to a certain point, you get the problem of I've run out of good opportunities for it, but I still have all the money and got to do something with it, right? So that's where it just makes the temptation for malinvestment much more, you know, that siren song much more compelling, right? Shit, I got all this money coming in. I can't just sit in. I got to do something with it. And yeah, maybe that sounds like a good idea, right? Okay, sure, right? And then you make the cardinal sin of banking, which is you make bad loans, right?
Silicon Valley Bank. I mean, the guy just couldn't, Dan Marks, their CFO, just couldn't sit on $100 billion. And like, you think like, I look at that and I think like, because all my good friends run all the hedge funds in the banking space. And they were telling Dan, like, Dan, your duration risk is too, you're taking on too much duration risk. But Dan was saying like, no. Our models say that though these are non-interest bearing deposits, and our models are telling us that non-interest bearing deposits have 7-year durations. You know what I mean? And so, because he's like, oh my God, I'm gonna make all this money, and then I'm gonna like make all this in my bonus. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You look at it, you're like, it's just a huge fundamental. These are just huge behavioral flaws that cause it.
And is it true that they were flying without a chief risk officer for the last 7 months or whatever?
It's ludicrous. It's ludicrous. And you gotta wonder why the former chief risk officer left.
Right.
I don't know. Good timing on her part, though.
Yeah, and I'm curious. Do you think that there will be, you know, there's the whole like, hey, these especially the top execs, you know, paid themselves big bonuses in the 12 months leading up. I mean, do you think there will be clawbacks? Are there provisions for that in the banking industry?
Okay, so like now you've hit on like the thing, all right? This is the thing. And I am not anti-rich. I'm not anti-capitalist. I'm like an uber capitalist, right? But if you're an uber capitalist, you're not in favor of people stealing from capitalists.
Right.
And you look at about the, across the banking industry, all right? And the attrition rate in banking is, I think there've been 40,000 banks that have either failed or merged, okay? And there's, let's call it 5,000 today, just for math purposes. So 8 times more have failed or merged, okay? So your attrition rate is really high. Then you look at, you take all the banks in the United States, public and private, and this is what's amazing about banking, you can get all the performance data of every institution, whether they're private or public. And you take all of them and you put them on a histogram. And what you'll find is that the majority of banks do not earn their cost of capital. And then you look at like the inflation going on in the pay for these folks. You think like, and they're talking about pay for performance, and they're bringing in these executive comp consultants who are like, oh, we need to pay these people more. Like, it's total bullshit. Okay, let me just show you one more chart. This gets to the crux of the fundamental issue. Where do I have that? Let me see here. But let me show you this. So then you say, well, look, what is the thing that allows somebody to deal in this context where you have to deal with abundance, not scarcity? What is that thing? And it is my, and I feel pretty strongly about this. So here is if you take every single publicly traded bank in the United States, you rank them by all-time total shareholder returns. So the total amount of value they've created since going public, there's two banks that are way out there on standard, in terms of like there's three, four standard deviations out. Glacier up in Kalispell, Montana, of all places, and then M&T Bank up in Buffalo, New York. M&T is the bank that I run the thing for, that guy who did this, okay? And the guy who runs Glacier is a real good friend of mine. And so you say like, okay, like they're way out there. Way out there. And then you look at this, you think, oh my God, those guys must be rich. They are rich. But how did they get rich? Here is how they were paid compared to their peers.
So yeah, if they didn't know that they were getting an overly generous, equity package, they really had to demonstrate growth in their bank. And
they forced their boards to keep their pay low. Their boards were like, we need to pay you more. We need to pay you more. We need to pay you more. They said, no, like, no, that's not what this is about. Like this, that is not about taking every nickel today, you know, maybe the expense of a dime tomorrow. These guys are like, because it impacts the entire organization. You can hire better. Your people are happier. Like you can buy other banks easier because people trust you. And it's like, it changes the entire dynamic of the whole thing. And then then you have that parabolic return curve that just goes straight up as a result of it. And so you look at this and it's like, I swear to God, you go through the 1980s and you look at the top 10, every highest paid every single year. You know what happened to their banks? Either they failed or they would have failed, but for forbearance on behalf of the regulators, because they were doing stupid stuff. Every single one. And so what you find is there's this inverse relationship. When we're being told all this stuff, and this is not about not getting rich, it's about getting rich on the right timeline, on the back end of the timeline, not on the front end. Because if you get rich on the front end timeline, you're doing stupid stuff with your loan book. You know what I mean? So it's right. This whole mentality that like you can really, and so you go, you look at who are the best bankers today. There's a guy by the name of Ross McKnight, right? He runs this bank called Interbank down in Texas, Oklahoma Panhandle. This guy's awesome, awesome, awesome. How much did he pay himself? $0. It's like, it's amazing how clear the data is.
And so his incentive is whatever equity grant he was given, he's just trying to grow the actual value of the bank, right?
I mean, Ross owns 100% of a $4 billion bank. So he does real well.
Okay.
And the same thing. So this is a bank, there's a bank in Abilene that if you look at every bank in the United States at their valuation, this bank trades like 3-4 times book. Your typical bank is at 1.5 times book. It's like nothing. Okay. And it's been trading like that for like 15 years. Like why? It's because it's consistent earnings. It doesn't do stupid stuff in wild times. It doesn't get punished in the bad times. And you look at how its CEO is paid, same damn thing. So it's like, you're like, it's uncanny. You know what I mean? How simple this stuff is, but like this cottage industry of these executive comp consultants, like, they just have just come in and kind of taken over.
Well, and I'm sure the execs love that and want to feed that consultant ecosystem because it means bigger, paychecks and grants for them.
Yeah. When I start talking about this stuff to them, I mean, they want to like to get the tar and the feathers.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. You're the guy who's basically, ruining the party for them. So maybe if we can, let's review the major developments real quick for folks. So first, everything was fine. We heard for years the banking system's strong. It's much better capitalized than it was prior to the 2008 crisis. We shouldn't worry about the banking system. Janet Yellen had famously said at one point, we're never going to see another banking crisis. And I'm not sure if it was our lifetime or her lifetime she was talking about, but basically trying to sell the story that, look, no matter what happens, like the banking system's the most rock solid part of the story at this point in time. Then all of a sudden we have three bank failures kind of in a row, right? Silvergate, Signature, and Silicon Valley Bank. Probably all for somewhat slightly different reasons. Silvergate was very exposed to what was happening in crypto. Silicon Valley Bank kind of had its own issues going on. What created the opportunity for those banks to just all of a sudden keel over?
Okay, so this is actually a really, really good question. This kind of touches on how the system works as a system, the financial system works. So if you go back You know, there's cycles, right? Everybody knows that there's these cycles that occur, and there's a whole bunch of cycles that occur all the time in industries. There's, you know, various cycles within industries. But if you just take the big cycles, there are these big cycles that the financial industry will go through. Okay. And then there are these little cycles. Well, if you think about the big cycles, you have to go back to 1973 for the beginning of the last big cycle. Okay. And I'll talk about each one of these, but then you go back from 1973, you got to go back to the 1870s. That's the beginning of the big cycle before the one that begins in 1973. And then before that, there's a series of smaller cycles that happen kind of recurrently in that period between the revolution and the Civil War. Okay. But let's take those off the table, because that's kind of a different scenario, what was going on back then. If you look at the three cycles, and then just recently with the coronavirus pandemic, that was the beginning of another cycle in the banking and finance industry. And I'll explain why. If you go back to 1870s, okay, what you saw back then was, this is when the United States was emerging kind of on the world scene, right? This is the American Industrial Revolution, right? Like the assembly line, all these things are coming to fold, right? So we're making tons of money. Europe is fighting. We're injecting all this produce into Europe. So we're making a ton of money. A ton of money is flooding into the United States. What happens? It's the birth of disposable income. The birth of disposable income happens in the United States. And so what happens then is all this money is flooding in and piling up, piling up, piling up. And what does the finance industry do? It arbitrages money. So it sees this huge pile of money. And it's like, oh God, let's go arbitrage that thing. So everything since then, that huge pile of money is built up, is that everything since it goes to in the 1920s, the craziness in the 1920s, all these regulatory and legal changes that happened in this period. And then the stock market flies up in this 1920s, and then it crashes in the Great Depression. Then you have those regulatory changes that come, you know, the FDIC and all these different things. And then that goes into World War II. So this goes all the way until 1973, okay? This cycle right here, from that big pile of money downhill until 1973. What happens in 1973 is there's a break in time. Just like a cut, it's like a fat, you're cutting the fabric of time, starting all over again. What causes us to start all over again? The oil crisis in 1973. So you had the Yom Kippur War. We support Israel. The Arab states retaliate against us by putting an embargo on oil exports to the United States. That causes oil prices to shoot up, inflation to shoot up. Paul Volcker then comes in and causes interest rates to shoot up. There's a mismatch crisis, and all these things happen. And then that leads into the financial crisis of 2008. And Ben Bernanke, he wrote a big paper on this, and he calls it the global savings glut. So that's the second big cycle of the modern era. The third one begins with the coronavirus pandemic, and here's why. So you think about that big pile of money with disposable income. That's one huge pile of money. You think about the second big pile of money, which is this pile of money that is amassing in the coffers of these oil-producing countries. They're euro dollars, because it's dollars, but they're not repatriated in the United States. They're just building up, building up, building up, building up, building up. So what do the banks want to do? Arbitrage that money. So they go and they arbitrage that money, right? And so everything since then has been happening as a result of that. And then the coronavirus strikes. And what happens? A ton of money floods into the system. A ton of money, right? You have the fiscal relief. You have the monetary relief. And like, look, like, why, like GDP in the second quarter of 2020, like what, like on an annualized basis, it fell like 30%, right? Which is huge. That's more than Great Depression. So the government comes and pours all this money into the system. And so now it's starting to make its way out of the system. And the one thing that we know when liquidity makes its way out of a system is that it never just quietly exits out the side door. It like bangs its way out the front. And so this was the first knock on the door that we'll see. And this could be, this will be, the, this pile of money will probably define, it could be 20 years, it could be 30 years, it could be 50 years. But that big pile of money will define the next few decades in banking. So this is the, remember those two piles of money I was telling you about?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the two piles of money right here. So this is the one on your left. That's your birth of disposable income. The one on your right, and I swear, just for aesthetic reasons, I made them like look like that. The one on your right actually should be like going out the same way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see the numbers are backwards.
Yeah, so that's euro dollars right there from that oil crisis. Now here's what's now. If you want to know like what caused those two piles of money, here's what it is. This is the entire history of the United States. Okay, this is the trade surplus versus the trade deficit. This is what it looks like. The first 96 years, every single year but for 4 years, was a trade deficit. It then switches every single year for 96 years, but for 4 years. I mean, it's uncanny. Is a trade surplus. Then it switches back every single year since basically 1970 has been a trade deficit. Well, the key thing is here is that when you switch between, when you have economy the size of the United States, it switches between a trade deficit into a trade surplus or trade surplus into a trade deficit. Think about the torrent of money you're dealing with there. Huge amounts of money. And so those are the things that begin the crisis, that began those two eras, those two big piles of money. Those the switches right there between those two things.
Wow. Okay. We're obviously very early on in that story. If this is a multi-decadal cycle and it just started with the pandemic, right? So we're technically, 2 years at most into it here. And you're sort of saying that it's the receding of this money from the banking system that's causing some of these, you know, weaker players to croak here. Alongside that, in the here and now part of the cycle is that the Federal Reserve and other major central banks are tightening as well, which cannot help the situation. And there is a big duration mismatch right now at a lot of banks. And by that, I mean, banks make their money by borrowing short and lending long. They have these big bond books that have basically lost a lot of value as interest rates have risen so far so quickly. And if you can last until those assets mature, you're fine. But if you get caught needing money in the interim, you have to sell those assets. Those unrealized losses now become realized losses. And bank can very quickly get into trouble. And as the headlines have helped us understand, that was really the big deal with Silicon Valley Bank, because they had fewer larger depositors. You know, as those depositors left, they were having to scramble to try to, you know, basically get the cash to give the depositors, and they were having to sell their book, and that's what caused them to implode. But that's not, while it was extreme at Silicon Valley Bank, it's not unique to Silicon Valley Bank at any point in time here. So where we are right now today, you know, what do you expect? Do you expect that dynamic to continue? And if so, should we be expecting to see more banks struggle as a result?
Okay, so what we're seeing right now, and I'll give just a little bit more context, and then I'll get into right where we are today, okay? So what happened in the, what triggered the Great Depression? The stock market crash of 29, Federal Reserve policy trying to suck liquidity out of the system. What triggered the crisis in the early 80s? So yeah, the interest rates, when they shot up, what was going on there? Volcker trying to suck liquidity out of the system. What is going on today? It's the Federal Reserve trying to suck liquidity out of the system. So what happens is when you put it all in there and then you start sucking it all out, it gets uncomfortable. So that's what's going on right now. So then you say, okay, why is Silicon Valley Bank, why is Silvergate, why is Signature, why are these banks at the forefront of this? Why are they kind of the canaries in the coal mine, right? Well, there's a couple of different reasons. So in the context of Silvergate, right, when you think of asset classes and you think of the ones that are like the furthest out on the risk continuum, you're talking about your cryptocurrency assets, right? I'm like, nobody really even knows. I mean, can you even call them an asset? I mean, it's like, you don't even know.
Nobody knows what fair value is. Yeah.
Nobody knows exactly what these things are, you know, like, and so like, this is way out there. And what's interesting is that Silvergate wasn't even a bank, really. I mean, it was, but it wasn't, right? What Silvergate was, is it was a trading platform that facilitated the real-time, 24-hour day, real-time, frictionless transfer of cryptocurrencies between the people on its platform. So when those cryptocurrency prices crashed, I mean, it just sucked all that money out of Silvergate. I mean, I think they lost something like 70% of their deposits over the course of like a week or two, and which is amazing that they even survived. So that's what was going on with them. So they made it. They made it to voluntary liquidation, which is like an incredible story in and of itself, that they weren't actually shut down. Then you move over to Silicon Valley Bank. Okay, now why is Silicon Valley Bank, why is it the next one to go? Okay, well, think back to where did all that liquidity go when it came into the system? Think about like, what was happening at the time. Remember, like everybody freaked out, but then all of a sudden the IPO started surging and everyone just wanted to go public and those IPO pricings were just going bonkers. Well, tons of that money flooded into the IPO market, found its way into Silicon Valley Bank because that's the people that were in the companies that this bank caters to. Then what happens? Then that liquidity starts to dry up. Those companies start to eat into their balances. So Silicon Valley Bank has got to start satisfying those deposits. And so when they're satisfying those deposits, because they had $100 billion of deposits flood in. This is like a $60 billion bank. And then $100 billion flooded into that bank. And they take those and they buy bonds with these, with all of that, because they're treating these deposits as they would treat any other deposit.
Right.
They all this money floods in. They have to start selling their bond, some of their bonds, to take care of that. And then that triggers the panic on Silicon Valley Bank, because they have to realize losses on their bond portfolio. So now we're at the state where the question is, are people going to be concerned that other banks will have to realize losses on their bond portfolios? Because there's two types of bonds, right? There's the held to maturity and there's available for sale. Available for sale, you have to mark to market. So as interest rates go up, bond prices go down. The banks, if they're in the held to maturity portfolio, it doesn't really matter. They just hold them. They don't have to adjust them for the value. But if they're available for sale, you do have to adjust them. So you got to mark them down, right? Well, that's the concern, that if all these banks have got to mark down their bond portfolios, I mean, I don't know what the stat is, but a good chunk of them would be actually probably insolvent. So the fear is that you have these kind of zombie banks that are insolvent because they're marking down their bonds. And then that is the thing that triggered those runs. And then to add insult to injury, in all of these cases, these banks had a very small portion of their deposits were actually insured by the FDIC. And so that it kind of added to that fear that people would lose their money.
Right. They had a lot of what are called uninsured deposits, particularly in the case of Silicon Valley Bank. You had these corporations that were the depositors. So when they tend to have a lot more money and you know, they were putting it all into a single account at Silicon Valley Bank, which is really pretty bad treasury management on the behalf of a company. You shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket like that. You combine that with Silicon Valley Bank's terrible risk management that it had, in addition to this duration risk we were talking about. It was just a recipe for disaster, and it was, and the rest is history here. What's interesting to me about this, and then I want to quickly get on to what the government did in the wake of these bank failures and get your opinion on whether it was the right thing to do or not. But what's so interesting to me about this is there's blame to be cast on many sides here, but really I place the majority of it at the feet of the Fed, because the Fed kept interest rates, you know, pursued its zero interest rate policy. It kept interest rates at really record lows for many, many years. And so the banks just reacted to the tune that the Fed was playing, right? And they got very used to a business model that, you know, was basically predicated on rates continuing to stay low. Not only did rates start to rise, but the Fed, you know, did a total 180 from being the guy who's doing everything they can to suppress interest rates to all of a sudden raising them the furthest in the shortest period of time that they ever have done in history. So I've been likening this in recent videos here to, you know, the Fed driving the car at 100 miles down the highway and then jamming on the brakes, right? And then everybody, all the banks are the bodies hitting the windshield right at this point in time, right? So in many ways, what's you know, what the banks are suffering from is just following the lead that the Fed had set for them. And now they're getting, you know, a lot of damage as a result of it. I guess first question is do you see that? Is what I stated at least sort of statutorily true?
So yes, I kind of your metaphor is, I think it's very accurate. But here's the question, Adam. So like, I think it's easy to Monday morning quarterback the Federal Reserve. Do you know what I mean? I think it's easy to step back and like look in hindsight and be like, you did it too fast. You kept rates low too long. But then like, if you actually go through the exercise and say like, okay, like I'm going to put myself in their position. Like it's actually, I think it's much harder when you think about it. And I think that same thing, my good buddy, Morgan Housel, who writes on this stuff, he talks about like, you know, it's easy for people to criticize and judge like these bankers as these greedy fat cat people doing this and doing that. But he's like, but you don't know how you would react if you were in their situations, facing their incentive structures and facing their constraints. And it's the same thing with the Fed. So whether it's a mistake, I don't know if it's a mistake, I guess is what I'm saying, but certainly kind of the factual scenario you laid out is kind of how that did unfold, certainly.
Yeah, well, people respond to incentives, and the banks have been responding to the incentives that the central banks had set for them until they changed the game. Right now, look, a couple of things. One, you know, I would never want Jerome Powell's job. I still can't believe that he willingly signed up for a second term, knowing where this was all going. So I don't want to pretend that I would necessarily do a better job in his shoes. That being said, won't keep me from doing some Monday morning quarterbacking. An obvious one there is, I think the Fed should have been started hiking a lot sooner, right? Or they should very least should have stopped all their asset purchases of treasuries and mortgage backed securities in 2021 as the inflation rate started rising, right? I mean, it was clear that they had a hand in making transitory last a lot longer than they thought it was initially going to work. But that's for the history books to decide. There's another issue going on here with banks that compounds this too, which is, and this is where I lay some blame at the feet of the banks, is once the Fed started hiking the federal funds rate, the banks did not commensurately raise the interest rates that they were offering to depositors. So, you know, we've gotten to the point where we are now where banks are earning, I don't know, what, 4.75% or whatever, you know, on their interests on excess reserves with the Fed. And yet they're paying depositors still on average across the country something, you know, almost statistically indistinguishable from zero, right? And so what's happening is money is beginning to flood to where it's better treated. People are taking their money out and they're putting it in T-bills that are yielding 4% plus. They're putting it in money market funds at their brokerage. I think a lot of these banks, you know, it may be too late for a lot of them to do this because they're capital impaired now and they just don't have the money to be able to do this. But you're kind of nodding as I'm saying this, but is that a factual or is that an understandable outlook, or do you look at it differently?
Well, there are important nuances. Okay. And so not all the accounts where money is put on deposit are equal in terms of interest rates, right? Your transaction accounts typically don't pay any interest rate at all. You know, your checking accounts, those right. kind of accounts, right? You go over into your savings accounts, they pay a little bit more. Your money market pay a little bit more. And then your CDs that can lock the money up for a while, they pay more. So the banks have responded with their CD rates and their money market accounts and those things, like those have gone up.
Am I correct? I mean, it's only been quite recently they've done that. I mean, I remember last year looking at the Delta and just saying, come on, banks, you guys are just raking the money in on this, on the arbitrage between what the Fed is paying you and what you're paying us.
And that's true. I mean, there is a lag between when the Fed drops the Fed funds rate and when the banks will drop their rates as well. There's certainly a lag. I don't look at that as being like a egregious lag, because there's lags on the asset side of the balance sheet too. I mean, like, these things all take time to adjust, and they're balancing both sides of that balance sheet.
So maybe it's not as nefarious as I thought it might be, but it still is the dynamic that I outlined in play, which is that money is just choosing to go where it's better treated here.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely accurate. Yeah. And let me to point out to kind of build off your word nefarious. So one of the things that I have done is I've cultivated a network of really like the top bankers in the country. And like, I know these folks, I know them personally, I know them well. And like, it's when you look on the outside, it's easy to look at them and be like, oh, they're like I said, like these greedy fat cats who are just like making money off of other people's money. But like at the end of the day, like these bankers are pretty exceptional people. Like, you go into a small town, you go into like a city, like who's sitting on the boards of like the, you know, United Way, who's doing the work with the, you know, Habitat for Humanity. There's always, always bankers there. Who's raising the capital for the hospitals. I'm not a banker, banking apologist, but like I'm around these people all the time and I kind of see what they deal with. And like, yeah, they're pretty good folks.
You're saying, hey, look, they're not mustache twirlers, you know, we're at the proletariat, right? They're doing their best. But maybe, you know, they're doing their best to run an imperfect system.
Yeah. I mean, what my grandfather used to say, what the last perfect man died 2,000 years ago. You know what I mean? It's like we could all cast aspersions on ourselves, I suppose.
Okay. So anyways, how big of an issue is the second one that I raised, which is the capital that's leaving the banks, in addition to the duration mismatch we talked about earlier?
Okay, so there's it's not capital that's leaving, it's liquidity is how you should think about it. And so there's two different types of liquidity. There's kind of the liquidity that sloshes around within a system, and then there's liquidity that sloshes in and out of a system. Mm-hmm. So it's that liquidity that sloshes in and out of a system that's really problematic. That's the type of thing that causes these beginnings and endings of these huge cycles. The liquidity that sloshes within a system isn't as big of a concern on a macroeconomic level, but there can be banks that get like individual institutions that get caught, right? And so Silicon Valley Bank, it got caught in a liquidity situation, right? Basically all the banks that are experiencing trouble right now are being caught in a liquidity situation, right? But they're not being caught because the interest rates in another place are higher. They're being caught because people are worried that the money in those banks won't be safe. So you're going to see this money sloshing around, but the money always constantly sloshing around. I mean, that's just kind of like how it goes. But the one thing I would say about right now is that, like, let's take Silicon Valley Bank. Okay. They go into this thing with $60 billion on their balance sheet, $100 billion floods in. Their CFO is sitting there thinking like, what am I going to do with this? If I keep it in cash, which probably what he should have done, right? And then hindsight, right? If I keep it in cash, what's that going to do? That's going to cause my return on assets to fall by 2/3. So return on assets, which is the principal profitability metric that analysts track, is going to fall to 1/3 of its former self. So then you have your investors and your analysts coming in on these banks and saying like, what are you doing? You need to invest that money. And so then he's thinking, he's probably sitting there thinking like, well, remember back at the time, we were thinking lower for longer. Remember that? Lower for longer, lower for longer. That's what everyone was thinking back then, lower for longer. So he's thinking lower for longer. So I'm going to go buy. Now, should he have done this? No. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, right? He goes and buys $100 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries that are that an average duration of 7 or 8 years. They're way out there, right? So that was the mistake. But if you put yourself back there, you can see why that happened. And so I think that that's just important context.
Okay, it is true. And when you say that sort of $100 billion came in and he's making those allocation decisions, where are you thinking about that? Is that like 2020? Or, okay, so it was back when we still had
2020 and 2021.
Okay, yeah. So this was back still when we had rock bottom interest rates and it looked like we were just going to get more of the same because we were still in a pandemic and everybody thought that the Fed was going to be, you know, largesse for everybody forever. So, events being what they've been, these three banks died. The authorities stepped in. Let's talk about Silicon Valley Bank and Signature specifically for a second. So kind of in lockstep, the Fed, the Treasury, and the FDIC said, okay, you know what? We're gonna protect 100% of the deposits in this bank, right? And I think first and foremost, that probably was done to try to prevent the First Republics of the world. So First Republic is another Bay Area regional bank kind of fighting for its life right now. Some steps have been taken to prop it up. We'll talk about in a minute, but you know, it's the concerns around Silicon Valley Bank spilled over into First Republic and are to you know certain extent hitting other banks as well. And I believe the logic behind this, okay, we're going to just cover 100% of deposits, was taken as an extreme step to just kind of quell fears so that we wouldn't have these other big bank runs. You're nodding as I'm saying this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But if you remember, the first thing that they did was they actually didn't say they were going to protect 100%. In that first communication after they seized Silicon Valley, they came out and said, we're going to give them these certificates that then once we kind of figure out the asset liability situation, then they can come in with those certificates and kind of turn those in. And then we'll see how much they get is basically what they said in that first communication. And there's that communication that triggered the contagion. At least that's what it looks like. Because then people were like, oh my God, like they're not going to cover all these deposits. So then they said, then people looked around and there was a list going around. I don't know if you got that list, but there's a list going around of banks that were ranked by percentage of deposits that were uninsured.
Yeah, I definitely saw
that. Yeah. So this thing goes around as then the runs start happening on all of those banks. So then the FDIC comes in and says, whoa. All right, you know what? Change of plans. We'll protect those deposits. We'll make sure you guys get all of those. And so that was the first kind of step that they took to kind of like back up kind of that initial, if you want to call it a mistake, by saying they weren't going to cover them all.
Okay. So let me ask you a question that is still not clear to me. So after this announcement, the world sort of interpreted this as, oh, well, the Fed just announced it's going to backstop 100% of all deposits in the U.S. retail banking system. I don't think that's what they said, although I understand people intuiting that from the action. There have been some attempts to get clarity. Janet Yellen was getting grilled on this a few days ago. What I took from her answers, and right now we're in the blackout period for the Federal Reserve, which will end tomorrow. So we'll actually be able to have journalists ask questions of the Fed and hopefully get some much needed clarity here. But as best we understand it right now, and this might be stale news by the time this video airs because of the Fed's conference, but it sounded like what Janet Yellen said was, no, we are only going to do this selectively. When there's a super majority of consensus that we should do it, both at the Treasury and the Fed, and then I, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, meet with the president and we agree it should be done, we're basically going to decide when and if we need to do this on a bank-by-bank basis going forward. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And that's kind of how they do it. Because you think about it like this, Adam. Like, so remember, if you go back to the 08 crisis, and that's the situation Ireland found itself in when it had to take over its banks and basically bankrupted the entire government. Like, it's really, really, even a government as big as the United States can easily be totally bankrupted by bank. And that's because banks can just grow. I mean, literally, there's infinite demand for credit. I mean, you can just grow. I mean, you could grow a bank from like, I mean, if you really wanted to, okay, and you had the capital to do it, you could literally grow a bank from like zero to $1 trillion over the course of like 3 years. I mean, it's just crazy what you can do because there's such a demand for credit. And so you want to be selective and careful about exposing your government's balance sheet to that kind of like that whole situation because it can get pretty messy, as Ireland found out.
Okay. So the people who are interpreting right now that the Fed just basically took a massive step forward towards socializing the banking system, sounds like that may be a extreme and maybe somewhat erroneous conclusion. I mean, I'm not trying to say it's not erroneous at all, in the sense that to a certain extent, the Fed and the Treasury are now going to pick winners and losers. Oh, we're going to backstop that bank at 100%, but that one we're just going to liquidate, and you know, depositors are going to get what they get, you know, however many cents on the dollar. So again, you're nodding as I'm saying this, but it sounds like, barring a clarification from Jerome Powell soon, that's sort of where we are in the story.
Yeah. Yes. So this is just how it always goes, right? Remember, 08, we backstop Citi, we backstop Bank of America, we backstop all these banks, right? But and then they even injected capital. Remember all that TARP money? They injected capital into banks. So it's like, but then we didn't turn into a socialist society. You go back, every single crisis is the same thing. The government steps in so it doesn't get as bad as it could get. It doesn't turn into a Great Depression. You know, they do these things that like maybe at the time are unsavory, but then everything typically goes back to normal. And that's what will happen here too.
Okay. So in addition to saying, hey, we're going to backstop these two banks at 100%, they also announced the Bank Term Funding Program, which was $25 billion that, you know, basically is there to be tapped by banks if they want to, as I understand it, if they've got kind of money good investments like treasury bonds, they can sell them at par, which the Fed will then hold and you know, eventually hold long enough to get the maturity. But in the interim, the bank is using that to remain liquid if it's in trouble. You're nodding as I'm saying this. I will say, when I heard $25 billion, my initial reaction was, that sounds really small, right? If we're having liquidity issues in the banking system, you know, JP Morgan and a bunch of 10 other banks just put $30 billion in First Republic just to keep that thing going a little while longer. Like, I feel like that could be drained by just one bank in trouble. So I guess my question is, what do you think of that step of the bank term funding program? Was it the right move? Was it a good move? Is it going to need to be added to? Are my concerns about its size valid?
So the term lending facility is an important one. You pointed out the most important part of it was that, so they're not, you're not selling your bonds. What you're doing is you're giving them to the Fed as collateral for loans. But when you give those bonds to the Fed as collateral, they give you what they give you the price of it at par. So you get all you get. There's not a discount as a result of the decline in value that comes that came about as a result of the rise in interest rates. So that's a key thing. Now the size, look, who knows? That's what I would say. We don't know if it's going to be big enough or not big enough. But what we do know is that typically when you make a facility like this available, it's more its availability than its size or any sort of specifics that helps to stem kind of the tide of the crisis, right?
You're saying it's kind of like an optics type of thing here.
That's exactly right. People know, like, okay, if a bank really needs it, it can go and get it. You know what I mean? So that can kind of stop, it can slow the panic, which I think that, you know, and it's hard to say, you know, what thing exactly slowed it or how much it slowed it, but that certainly kind of played into kind of the response.
Okay. So maybe going back to my thoughts about, it seemed really small. You know, maybe what you're saying is hey, it's a good move because you didn't have to put that much money in play to kind of make people feel a lot less worried that the banking system is going to be taken care of.
Yeah, it was the same thing with TARP, although TARP was obviously a lot bigger. I think it ended up being $800 billion or something like that. But it's just the availability of these, it's a pressure release valve that if a bank needs it, it can go in and get it. And $25 billion is, you cited First Republic, right? You have the big banks come in and put $30 billion in there. And is that going to be enough? Nobody knows. But what we do know is that it lost something like $70 billion in deposits in a single day. So hard to say if that's going to be enough or not. But just the fact for most banks, $25 billion is going to get you a long way.
Okay. So we also have banks that are going and using what's called the discount window. And actually the usage of the discount window has exploded in the past couple of weeks. So can you just really briefly talk about the discount window, how it differs from the Bank Term Funding Program? And also in your answer, if you can, you know, presumably banks really don't want to have to borrow from the discount window if they can help it, because it does get reported. And it's, I've heard it sort of akin to covering yourself in blood before you jump in shark infested waters, right? It just sort of lets the world know that you're weak, and therefore, bad things happen when the world knows that.
Okay. So what is a central bank? What is the Federal Reserve? The Federal Reserve is a central bank. What is a central bank? A central bank is a lender of last resort. Okay. So what does that mean? Banks typically don't, they make bad loans, and everybody does that a little bit here and there. But the typical issue in a crisis is not a capital issue, it's a liquidity issue. And that is, and you can read back all the crises in the past, what happens is there'll be people coming in to get their money. And it's not that the bank doesn't have the money, but it's that it doesn't have the money in like money form. It's in bond form, or it's in loan form, or another type of asset form.
Yeah, this is the Jimmy Stewart speech from It's a Wonderful Life.
Exactly. So they got to transfer that stuff over into cash, right? Well, when you go into one of these things, your market seize up, or they demand huge discounts on any assets that are sold, particularly by financial institutions. So that puts these financial institutions into a real tight spot, right? Because if they sell those at discounted prices, then you can have a capital issue, right? And the capital issue can make you insolvent, and then the FDIC comes in on Friday and gets rid of you, right? So what you have is you have the Federal Reserve will step back and they'll say, okay, we're going to open this window, the discount window. We will take certain types of assets that are risk-free, and we will discount those. So we'll lend on those. So we'll give you the cash for those. So then you just kind of, you pointed out the fact that like there is this general kind of a negative impression of banks that go to the discount window. And that is true. It's unfortunate, but it's true. And that's because if that is the case, the presumption is that like there is a higher demand for cash coming out of that bank, maybe because of a run or withdrawals, than they're able to satisfy on their own or in private markets. So it's just, it could lead one to believe that there is an issue. But really what you want in a situation like this is you'll have the bigger, safer banks come in and use the discount window as well. That's basically providing cover for the banks that really need to use it. So the big banks are just saying, hey, look, everybody's using this thing. Don't worry about it. So that's why you'll have the pickup in the discount window usage. It's not just because more banks need it, but it's because the responsible banks also say, let's go on to the discount window as well to provide cover for the ones that do need it.
Okay. And I'm doing this from memory, so this might be wrong, but I think the last chart I saw, you know, a couple of days ago on the usage of the discount window in the week after Silicon Valley Bank went down was something like, I don't know, like in the, around 150 billion, sort of somewhere in that general range. If that's wrong, please correct me. But is it a concern that we're seeing such a dramatic surge so quickly in usage of the discount window right now? Like, does that say something about the banking system? Or should we feel relieved that, you know, these people have a backstop that they're now using?
Well, the discount window is one of those things where it's not like it like just gradually goes up. The discount window is one of those things that just goes up. When you need it, it just goes up, right? Because panics strike like that, right? Panics strike unexpectedly and quickly. Like Silicon Valley, I mean, they basically went down in a day. This is a $200 billion bank and went down in a day. You know what I mean? The Federal Reserve, I mean, the FDIC didn't even have, they couldn't even take all of Friday to seize it. They had to go in Friday morning. And so like, it's at those moments, right when that's happening, where the discount window demand surges, right then. And so if the discount window is working, that's what you're going to see. So that's a good sign, not a bad sign. I mean, I would say that this is just signs of that the system is working is how I'd interpret that.
Okay. All right. So the question that I'm working my way up to here through all this is kind of how worried should people be? And then also sort of a follow on of what do you think is going to come next, right? Is it going to be scarier stuff or things are going to start, you know, looking better, right? Before I get to those two questions, though, there are a few others that I want to ask here around current risks to the banking system. So we talked about duration risk. We talked about money deposits leaving banks to go where it's better treated, potentially outside of the banking system. You know, Treasury bills at Treasury Direct is an example. There's the general fear of just, you know, people get spooked, right? And hopefully that's quieting down a little bit here. But one of the things that that's doing is that is taking money from the smaller banks. And really by smaller banks, I mean like almost like every bank, but the top six, because we have such a concentrated banking system and that capital is going into those bigger banks, right? If you've got your money in a regional credit union, and you're worried because, especially if you're out in the Bay Area where Silicon Valley Bank just blew up overnight and everybody thought that was the white shoe bank out here, you're probably thinking, look, my money's probably safer in one of these really big mega banks like JP Morgan or Bank of America or whatever, right? So we're seeing that money leave the smaller banks. Now, and here's where I'm getting to. There are, for these smaller banks, again, so most types of loans, more of those loans are held by the bigger banks than the smaller banks collectively. That's not the case with commercial real estate. The smaller banks own a much larger share of commercial real estate loans than the big banks do. And the commercial real estate industry is looking quite vulnerable. It has been because of the pandemic and, you know, all the companies vacating their office leases. But now with rates having moved up as high as they have, you know, you've got mortgages are much more expensive to maintain for anybody who had a variable mortgage or whatnot. So that seems to be a big shoe that's about to drop on the banking system that's going to hurt these smaller banks more. Similarly, the auto loan market really seems to be in the process of, I don't know if imploding is too strong of a word, but default rates there are really beginning to ramp up quickly. And it's largely due to, again, you know, dynamics that were created during the pandemic that are almost making the auto loan market, I think, kind of like what the subprime housing loan market was back in 2008, where there were just a bunch of bad loans being made willy-nilly to kind of anybody who could fog a mirror during the, you know, the craziness of the pandemic where, you know, people had hot money to spend and, you know, dealers were happy to get the loans. So how big of a concern are those two shoes in terms of the health of the banking system going forward?
Let me address, I'll address that in a second. So there's this idea of small banks and large big banks and where the money is flowing right now. And so to your point, there's an argument that the money is flowing from the small banks to the big banks, because there's an implicit guarantee of your JP Morgan Chase's, your Citi's, your Bank of America's, your Wells Fargo's, because like the government ain't going to let one of those things go down, or it's going to be a freaking disaster. Right.
So, sorry, but just to tie this back earlier in the conversation, when Janet Yellen said, at our discretion, we're going to determine if we need to step in, probability is infinitely higher they're going to step in and protect JP Morgan than random little, you know, regional bank of Poughkeepsie.
Yeah, they will not step in for regional bank of Poughkeepsie, and they will step in for JPMC. That's exactly right. It's guaranteed on both sides of that, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, but here's the thing. And I've been talking to a lot of folks that are involved in these conversations right now. And you hear different, I mean, I talk to like dozens of bankers. I talk to people who talk to dozens of bankers. And so like, there's probably a few hundred banks in the immediate orbit. And like, it's not clear that the money is flowing out of the big, small banks right now. It's just not clear. Maybe the data will eventually show that when the next call reports come out, but that's not what I'm hearing. And maybe I'm not listening to the right banks, but I'm not hearing that from the bankers. I am hearing that from people who are making the argument.
I mean, I think some of these companies like JP Morgan and Schwab and others are saying, hey, we're seeing inflows of X. So that money's coming from somewhere, maybe not from the regional banks, but it's coming from somewhere, it seems.
When you think about like First Republic, that was a big bank, $70 billion left in a day, $40 billion left in a day from Silicon Valley. So you're already up to $110 billion from just those two. And then you got your Western Pacific. So if you quarantine the banks that are the targets of the runs right now, I mean, you could be talking, there could be $500 trillion in deposit outflows just from those, right?
That might explain the vast majority of what they're seeing is what you're saying. Got it.
That would be my guess, but I'm not sure. All I know is that we're not, from what I can tell, we're not seeing it from the little banks kind of scattered throughout the country. Okay. So you have that element. Now it's the question is, so you're talking about the two types of loans, credit, so CRE, right? And the auto loans, and right, whether that's going to cause a bigger credit issue. Let me add two more categories of loans to that sure, buckets. Okay. Cause this is where the small banks really, really are important. And that is ag loans. Small banks make 80% of the ag loans in the United States. Okay. And so you think like, why are there so many banks in the United States? There's 4,700 commercial banks in the United States. I think the next largest country has like 400 or something like that. I mean, like way, way smaller. Well, the reason is like where we sit on the globe. Like you look at the United States of America, I mean, this is like really good land. I mean, it's like you drive through like Iowa, you drive through Illinois, you drive through Ohio, you're like, that's some really, really good land. You know what I mean? Like really good farmland, really good, you know, to grow corn, to have like livestock. Well, all of those loans are really bespoke loans. You got to go and you got to know like the farmer, you got to know how does he treat his equipment? Like where does the water sit on his property? So those are all handled by people on the ground at these small banks. Okay. So that's why we have so many banks. And that's why those banks make all of those loans. CRE is another one. Again, CRE is bespoke stuff. You got to know the dirt, right, that you're lending on. And you got to like, how did that dirt perform in the last crisis? All these different things.
And sorry, just so folks can follow you, when you say CRE, you're talking about commercial real estate. That's the acronym for it.
Exactly. Commercial real estate. And like, and you'll notice like when you study these things, like a certain piece of property will perform better or worse in certain cycles. And like you want lenders who know how that piece of property is going to perform through cycles. That's really bespoke knowledge, right? And so that's why these small banks handle all of those. So the question is, given that small banks handle all of these things, is it a concern that small banks do not have an implicit government guarantee of all their deposits, basically like the big banks? I don't know the answer to that. Because you either say, look, like we're either going to insure all deposits or not. You know what I mean? Like that's a societal question. It's not a banking question. That's a societal question because that's part of the safety net, right? Like, we just have to, like, this has to be a policy decision that has to be made, or you leave it up to the regulators in the crises to make, you know, specific, you know, exceptions to it and basically let the little banks suffer at the expense of the big banks. But again, I'm not seeing the concern about the little banks right now. So it's not as big of a concern to me that these loan categories are going to be impacted just because like, I'm not seeing that impact that people are kind of talking about in a theoretical sense.
Okay. That's really interesting. That's useful intelligence to have. So it sounds like in your conversation with these regional bankers, they're at least not saying, oh my God, all my deposits are walking out the door. Right. So that's good to hear. Right. And look, you know, one of the reasons why I'm really digging into this is we want to have a resilient, healthy banking system with a lot of competition in it. We don't want to have all these small banks die off and just have the too big to fail banks get even too bigger to failer, right? it's good to hear. I don't know if we've necessarily seen the worst yet of what's going to happen with commercial real estate loans and with auto loans, and obviously the higher for longer policy that's going on right now is just going to hasten whatever implosion may happen in those markets. So I guess maybe it's just a big TBD, but those do seem to be two areas where the regional banks are a lot more exposed. I know less about the ag world. I'm going to guess it's maybe not as vulnerable as, say, commercial real estate is right now, but I could be wrong. Who knows?
Well, and the thing to keep in mind, Adam, is that there's always cycles. Do you know what I mean? There's like always cycles. So it's like, yeah, the credit losses go up and credit losses go down. And so it's like, it's not a scary thing, or like, unless they go up to like Great Depression type of levels, then that could be a little scary, but like, it's just an it should be anticipated. And so when you think about it from like a person, you say, okay, like, why do I care? Why does it matter? What should I do about it? You know what I mean? Like, basically what it means is like, you got to build in some resiliency into like your balance sheet. You know what I mean? Like, if you really want to think about it on an individual basis, because like these things happen, cycles happen. Like, people lose their jobs when cycles occur. So it's like, you can talk about it in theoretical context, but like on an individual level, it really is about like being able to make it through those things.
So let's get to that in just one second, because I think you're making two really important points. There's that one, but then there's also, look, like, the natural progression of an economy is the boom bust cycle, right? And I'm one of those guys who will get on a soapbox and say that the Fed and the rest of the government complicit has really tried to break those cycles, right? They've tried to have it always be eternal summer, right? And the more that you distort the system, inevitably you get the bust, but the bust is a lot worse than it otherwise would have been, right? So you want these sort of healthy, shallower boom bust, you know, repeating cycles. And during a bust, you're going to lose banks, right? That's what happens, right? My concern is more of a generic, you know, garden variety bust of the smaller banks, and more of like a conflagration that just ends up, like I said earlier, with a lot fewer smaller banks and much bigger to big to fail banks. And there is a chart, which I'll find and I'll put back up here, which shows the number of FDIC backed banks since the turn of the century, and they've been in decline. I mean, they've almost like cut in half, right? So we are, to some, it's a concerning trend, right? And from what I'm hearing you say is like, hey, you're not at a DEFCON level one, you know, worry about that, at least not yet, from the folks you're talking to, which is good. So feel free to opine on that in any way you like. But to your second point, there are bank failures, you know, good years and bad. You could say, hey, as long as you got under 250,000, you really shouldn't worry, because if your bank fails, FDIC is going to come in on a Friday afternoon, your bank's going to be open on Monday, you're going to get your money back, and you can decide whether to keep it in the new bank or walk it across the street to another, no harm, no foul. Are there other things that you would recommend people do on the individual side of things to build resilience here?
Yeah, there are. But can I share my screen?
Yeah.
I'm going to show you, because your point about the, let's look at this one. The population of banks in the United States is a really good point. Okay. So this is, if you take the population of banks going all the way back to the beginning of the United States, 1800. So 10 years after Washington was inaugurated for the first time. Okay. This is what the population of banks looks like. Okay. So you see this huge buildup, so it's kind of flat. In around the 1860s, 1870s, it starts to turn up. And then there's a relatively sharp turn up in the 1880s, 1890s, and then it just shoots higher.
Yeah, right. Massive exponential. Look at that.
Yeah, it just shoots higher. And then that top point there is around 31,000 banks at that point. Okay. That's 1921. And then in the 1920s, there was a drought across the United States. And so just thousands of banks were failing every year in the agricultural areas. So that starts it to go down. And then the Great Depression, when we had all those bank runs in 30, 31, and 33, and we had a bunch of failures then. And then, you know, FDR had the bank holiday, and then we didn't open up a whole bunch of banks after that. So then that's when that comes down and it goes on that flat kind of, there's a, then a that plateau that goes across. See that? Now plateau is known as the Great Moderation. That plateau is a function of risk appetite in the banking industry is like nothing, right? Because all these people lived through the Great Depression. They're like, we don't want any more of that.
Right. Like, the generals are all fighting the last war. Exactly.
Yeah, we're like, yeah, we don't, no, thank you. You know, so they're like, they're pedestrian profitability. They're not taking any risk, blah, 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 blah. Right. So no failures, nothing else is really going on. There's no bank, not a lot of bank creation. But then when you see that tail, then it kind of spikes up right there. That's after that oil crisis, right? And that's when you have all that money building up in another place. So you have all these banks flooding in because interest rates are going higher, so you can earn more on your loans. And then at that peak of that tail is 1985. And that year is significant because that was the year that the Supreme Court said that states can give banks the right to merge, like to have interstate banks within regional compacts. So like Connecticut can agree with Delaware that that banks can bank across interstate lines in those two states. So when that was a dam that broke, and then that opened up the way for all the consolidations. So then the laws were changed. So then you could bank across interstate lines, you could have branches, all those things. So then that's what opened the way for the consolidation that you're talking about right now. Okay. But here's the important thing to recognize about this whole chart. So there's those individual kind of movements in each of the chart in that chart. But then there's the whole, you got to step back and look at the whole thing. Look at like the whole thing, okay? And what that whole thing is a huge bubble that was brought about by the birth of disposable income. That's what this whole thing is, okay? That's the story of banking in America. Banking and disposable income was born here. All these banks shoot up to get founded to like arbitrage that money. And we are still coming down from that. Now, the question is, how far down do we come? And this is like a big question in banking. And here's what, and everybody, people just like throw out these random numbers. These like, what, thought leaders or whatever. Like anybody who calls himself a thought leader, of course, like, you know what I mean? You got to wonder about that. But like, yeah, when they throw out a number, you're like, what are you basing it on? And here's what you should base it on, okay? The reason we still have so many banks in this country relative to other countries, and we do have probably too many, right? Because it's a fungible product. So it's like, it's really competitive, right?
And that is true. Just to interrupt, folks, if you're watching this in the US, you know, we've been hearing a lot from our Canadian counterparts recently. When we talk about being concerned of ending up with just a few banks, they're like, yeah, welcome to our world. You know, we've got just like, you know, a single digit number of banks you can bank with here in Canada.
But look at their economy and look at our economy. Like half of Canada is covered on ice. It's just like, you know, don't need it.
Hey, don't pick a fight with the Canadians in the comments section.
Well, I'm not picking a fight with them, but I'm just saying, like, you don't need banks in those areas making loans.
Right,
you
know, right.
Whereas like, we have all this farmland where you need banks on the ground making loans. And so the thing that will dictate the number of banks that we end up with in the United States is the consolidation in the ag sector. That is the thing that will dictate it. If these big companies move all the way down and then pick up all these individual farms, there's then no reason for a bank to be the one that spreads the risk, because the risk could be spread within the industry, right? But so long as you have all these individual farms all over the place, there's still going to be a demand for thousands of banks in the United States, just because like you need to make those bespoke loan products for those banks. So that's what this is. This is about a bubble coming off of the birth of disposable income. And how far we go will be dictated by consolidation in the ag sector.
Huh, interesting. So for those that are concerned about bank consolidation inside the U.S., you really have to understand the story of agriculture in the U.S. to see where the puck is headed.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Let me show you one other chart in here that you might find interesting. Let's see where I think I go. Okay. So this goes to your point about the Federal Reserve, okay? And the the regulators and the policymakers' responses in crises, okay? So this is all the major bank crises in the history of the United States, all right? It starts back in 1809. Then we have one in 1819, 1837, 1857, the Civil War. Then you have 1873, 1893, the Great Depression. And then over on the far right, you have that there's like all those crises that struck in the 80s. And then you have the financial crisis, okay? One thing you notice when you look at all these crises is what? You notice a double bump, right? Bump, 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 bump. Like, what is that, right? What is that double bump? Here's what it is. You have a credit bubble that expands too far. And then that naturally, the economy naturally reacts, starts sucking that liquidity out of the system. You have bank failures, okay? So that's that first spike. But then what happens next? Then you have the policymakers come in and change a whole bunch of stuff to try to make the situation better, but almost invariably they make it worse and it causes another spike in bank failures. And this is the same thing all the way through all the crises, but for the financial crisis of 2008. So you say, well, why was that was the first crisis in the history of the United States where we did not have this double bump of bank failures, okay? And why is that? It's because the guy who was running, love him or hate him, the guy who was running the Fed at the time was an expert on the Great Depression. And he knew that like what you do is you just come in because the Federal Reserve really screwed the pooch on the Great Depression, okay? And so he knew that what you got to do in situations like this, you just got to come in and give it all you got. And then that's what they did. And they just basically took care of it in one fell swoop.
Wow, that's fascinating. It does help you. One of the things that I've really enjoyed about this conversation and if you've got another chart to grab there, feel free, but you're really helping us see through the eyes of the banker in terms of how the bankers think and see the world. Have something to say about this chart?
This is just another, I think you'll just find it interesting, okay? So there are, in any industry, in any discipline, there are seminal charts, right? That are like, you should just know what this chart is. You should be like burned into your, it's kind of seared into your memory, okay? But then there are seminal shapes of charts, okay? So in banking, one of the seminal shapes of charts you'll see is like this one right here. This is Citigroup's annual earnings going into the financial crisis, okay? Up, 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 and then just crashed overnight, okay? And they crash way down, okay? So this is like one of those seminal charts. Like, and I like to think about this as like, you know, everything is fine until it isn't. And that's what it is. Everything is fine, and then it isn't, right? Yep. It's like Tlaib's turkey metaphor, right? So this is the extreme version of this. I just ran a banking symposium for the top bankers in the United States in Philly 2 weeks ago. And so when I go and visit CEOs, I'll make these really cool charts about their banks, but I'll kind of mask them and make them not immediately apparent what it is. And then I'll slide them across the table to the CEO and I'll say, what's that chart? And then they'll sit there and they'll process it for a couple minutes. And then we'll have this like really rich conversation about it because it's my interpretation of their bank. And it'll be different invariably than their interpretation. And so I did this game with this whole room of like these top CEOs. We'd put up a big chart on the screen and we'd say, you know, what's that chart? Then we'd have a conversation about it. And so this is one of those seminal shapes, but this is, and these are, you can find thousands of these, literally thousands of these in the banking industry's history. This is the cumulative earnings of a bank that was in Arkansas, okay? Cumulative, and it's founded in 1994. So you add each year's earnings up, and then in the financial crisis, it lost so much in 1 year that its cumulative earnings went negative.
Went negative net, yeah.
And this is important to realize because banks are highly leveraged institutions, okay? Like this idea that banks need more capital. I mean, what's crazy, Adam, is like we came out of the last crisis, okay? The 2008-2009 crisis. And what's the lesson we learn? What is the thing that's codified in the legislation? We need more capital, right? We need more capital. The banks need more capital, blah, 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 right? And you can tie that to a specific book that was written called, I think it was The Banker Has No Clothes. And it was about like this was all caused by too much leverage and not enough capital. Okay, so we go and we raise capital requirements. So what do they do? Like raise capital from, let's say from 10 to 12%, right? Like what is that? Like, it does nothing. It has no impact on the banking system. Because why? Because if you're making bad loans, it doesn't matter if you have 10% or 12% of capital, it's all going to be gone. You know what I mean? It's all gone, right? And so when you think about this, it's like, there's almost needs to be a level setting of the thought process around banking and how to secure a banking system. And it cannot be founded upon capital, because that is just not going to do it. And the way I think about it and I articulate it is that, like, everybody says that capital is king, right? Capital is king, capital is king, capital is king. But the reality is that capital is not king. It's more like the court jester. Confidence is king. You need people to believe in you. And that's how you secure the banking system, is by doing things that secure confidence, not by promoting this idea of capital, which isn't going to work, you know, in the worst case anyways.
All right. So a different way to say that would be to say, to make sure that when things get wonky, you are doing everything you can as the guys running the system to let people know you'll do whatever you need to, quote unquote, whatever it takes to rescue the system if need be.
Which is what we've seen, right, over and over again.
Okay. Like I said, you're really helping us, you know, crawl into the mind of a banker and the central bankers and how they look at the world here. All right. Well, so three last questions for you as we wrap up here, and they're all pretty big questions. One is, given what you know of the system right now, we didn't actually get a chance to talk about Credit Suisse much, but that is a more systemic bank. The risk of contagion of something going bad there is a lot higher than the smaller U.S. banks we were talking about. But given everything you know about what's going on right now and what the authorities are doing right now, how worried should people be? A little, medium, a lot?
I mean, okay, this is going to sound trite, okay? But I would say that you're wasting your time if you're being worried.
Okay.
You should go do other things. Like, what good is it going to do to be worried? Like, are you going to, like, this is what I do when I get worried? I like eat like 50 Oreos. Like, that's not going to do me any good. You know what I mean? Trust me, my wife will attest to that. Like, the system works. The system is fine. We don't have huge credit bubbles like we did in subprime mortgages back in 2007 that led into 2008. We're just not seeing that, right? So yeah, we may have a garden variety of recession, right? Like, those happen all the time, right? But the world isn't going to hell. Everything's not going to break. I mean, everything is just fine. So I would just, and again, this sounds trite, like, just chill and just, like, go to work, do a good job, mow your lawn, clean your kitchen. I mean, like, just do the normal things, but everything will work itself out.
Okay. Okay. So again, just from your perch as a guy that has spent, you know, the past 15 years or so following the banking industry and who talks to bank CEOs for a living, you're not seeing anything that's making you raise a flag to say, hey, everybody, we gotta really watch out for a contagion of failed banks sweeping across the country.
That doesn't mean we're not going to see more failures. Okay. That doesn't mean that.
And as you and I talked about, you know, in a regular bus cycle, you're going to lose banks, right?
This is not irregular. If anything, if you compare this to all the other past crises, this is a little baby crisis, little baby one. Okay. It's like, this is like the one in 1884, the one in 1907, a little baby one, not a big one. And, like, I mean, I guess, like, it could get worse, but there's no reason, not that I see, to think it's going to turn into one of those ones.
Okay. So then my next question, maybe you've already kind of answered it, which is, what comes next? And maybe your answer is well, not that much. the system will run the way that it normally does. Yeah, we might lose some banks, some more weaker banks as this goes along, but you'd lose them in every recession. Is it pretty much going to be that way? Or is there anything else extraordinary you think we should be keeping our eyes out for?
Inflation. Everything will be... inflation is the issue, right? It was inflation that caused the Federal Reserve to raise rates as fast as they did, which is further and faster than they've ever raised rates, even faster than 1881. Okay. And so, like, if inflation continues at its 5%, 6% rate, I mean, that's problematic. You know, let's be honest, because the Federal Reserve has a legal mandate to stop that.
Right. And so sorry to interrupt, but how problematic is it for banks that Powell is likely to continue hiking from here, right? Making that duration problem worse.
Well, there's two sides of the duration, or of that coin, right? Like, on the one side, you have what's going on in the securities portfolio and how that impacts security prices or the valuation of securities, right? But a lot of those are in the held to maturity. The majority of those are in held to maturity. So like really, man, just forget about those, right? So there is, we've now been through the pain for the most part of what's going to happen there. Like there can still be some more, but like we've been through the pain.
Yeah, now, and we now have the new facilities to help ameliorate
it. Yeah. Exactly. Banks have been waiting for higher interest rates. They've been waiting for a rising rate environment because their loan portfolios. I mean, one of the problems that First Republic had was like, I mean, it was making loans at like 1.5% on these jumbo mortgages. I mean, like a bank has got to be able to earn more on that money or else it goes out and does stupid stuff with it. Yep. So there's two sides of the coin. I would say that by and large, banks would be better from rising interest rates because their loan books are so much bigger than their securities books.
Okay. So then when you go back to inflation as something we should expect, does that have an impact on the banking system per se? You're just saying as people, we should just be aware that inflation is still around.
Well, yeah. So then you have in the banking system and inflation. So inflation, it goes up, like you should anticipate a recession will come about if inflation stays high, right? Like that's almost a guarantee that the Federal Reserve is doing its job. Okay. Now the question is in the banking sector, if you're a bank and you make good loans, it's like Christmas morning, right? Because your portfolio will make it through that thing just fine. Your competitors who are not as prudent as you are will not make it through as well, right? But you can go buy them for like pennies on the dollar, right? So there will be higher credit losses in the banking system, but by and large, the majority of banks make pretty good loans. And so the more money they will earn from their interest, their net interest, their portfolio of interest earning assets relative to their interest bearing liabilities, that will outweigh your credit losses over a multi-year period. But again, like there's the recession for the individual and the higher job losses and stuff like that. That's kind of what I was referring to about being worried about the inflation.
Okay. All right. And so just to put a little bow on this, sounds like you would say just sort of as a regular citizen of the nation, be more worried about inflation and its impacts on your particular lifestyle and situation versus, a collapse of the banking system right now.
Save money. That's what I would say. Save money. Always save money. Always save money. You know what I mean? You know that, Adam. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Always have money. Always have money stored away. There's this idea in America that, like, I love America. Like, I love America. You know what I mean? But like, there's this idea about like everybody wants to be rich, but that's actually not what people want to be, right? They just want to spend a lot of money. You know, like in their mind, they equate being rich with spending a lot of money. Now you hang out with rich people, and what do? They don't spend any money. You know what I mean? Like, there's a reason for that, right?
Well, we interviewed William Danko on this program, who is one of the co-authors of the seminal book, The Millionaire Next Door, back in the 90s, right? And which was a survey of self-made millionaires and actually of all millionaires. But what they found was the single most common attribute of self-made millionaires was the fact that they had a very frugal lifestyle, right? Frugality was quality number one. All right. Well, look, Jonathan, it's been a really great discussion. Like I said, several times, you're really helping us sort of think about the banking system the way that the bankers themselves think about it. And I find that very helpful and instructive. Really appreciate you coming on here. For folks that have enjoyed the discussion, maybe meeting you for the first time in this interview, where can they go to learn more about you and your work?
So I write for a number of different publications, but the best way to find my work is on Twitter. Maxfield on Banks is my handle. And then the other thing, and kind of go back to the very beginning of our conversation, Adam, to get back to Mr. Edwin Dorsey. Edwin convinced me to start a Substack. And so I've started a Substack, and I'm really producing I did a lot of research over the last 15 months that's very proprietary, and I haven't released it yet. And so that's going to be the place where I release all that research. So if you're interested in banking and really what is on like the cutting edge, kind of like out on the vanguard of banking, you'll find your way to it at some point. But if you find it through this podcast, that'd be awesome too.
Great. Well, what's the URL of the Substack?
Maxfield on Banks.
.substack.com?
.substack.com. Yeah.
Great. Okay. So Jonathan, when we edit this, I will put up the URLs to both your Twitter handle and your Substack there so people know exactly where to go. thanks so much. Very quickly, folks, I just want to remind folks that, The Wealthion online conference was this weekend. If you didn't get a chance to attend live and you're kicking yourself, don't worry. You can actually purchase replays of the entire conference over at wealthion.com/conference. And a reminder too that if you're wrestling with decisions about what to do with your money, given a lot of the topics that Jonathan and I talked about here, if you don't have a good financial advisor to act as your counsel in that decision-making process, feel free to talk to one of the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. Just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. You have a free consultation with the guys. Doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with them. It's just a free service that those guys offer. Jonathan, thanks so much. Really appreciate the time here today. Look forward to having you back on the channel again in the future.
Your pleasure, Adam.
All right, then. Well, folks, look, if you've enjoyed this conversation, would like to see Jonathan back on the channel, please do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button and clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Jonathan, thanks so much again, buddy. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.